Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. It's an honor to welcome back Adam Naiman, who's a critic, lecturer, and author based in Toronto. Adam writes for The Ringer, Reverse Shot, Criterion, The New Yorker, Sight and Sound, and more, and teaches cinema studies at the University of Toronto. He's also written several books on film, including titles on Showgirls, the movies of the Coen brothers, Paul Thomas Anderson, and David Fincher for Abrams. Well, Adam, I want to thank you so much for coming back. I always have the best conversations with you. I learn so much, and it's just the most engaging conversations. So how are you doing?
I'm doing well. We're hanging in here in the cherished 51st state.
Yes.
We're talking in the aftermath of the Canadian election. And now I would be very happy to move back to the mid-20th century and talk about some crime novels turned into movies.
Yeah, I thought this was a really cool idea. So clever. I knew the name Ira Levin, but I didn't put together just how many genres he had covered. What was it about the author that attracted you and made you think this was a good idea to explore?
Well, I think that he is known for being a writer who sort of generated film adaptations, and certainly he didn't invent the idea of literary or even popular, popular fiction movie adaptations. But historically, he's really a progenitor of the modern idea of it. You know, the kind of movie that's written, the book that's written almost as a stealth screenplay,
Yes.
or almost with the film rights attached, because he's post-war noir, and he's sort of contemporaneous with crime writers and sci-fi writers. He kind of, dips his toe in all these different genres. But he is really analogous, I think, to the Michael Crichtons of the world, a
Yes.
little bit ahead of Stephen King, certainly before someone like John Grisham, where the lack of literary pedigree is perceived because the books became movies. And because there's no prose style to really celebrate. If you read reviews of Ira Levin, and there are less reviews of his writing than you would think, the people who like him say, well, he doesn't let style get in the way of plot. And the people who don't like him say, all this guy does is make plots. There's no style, there's no digression, there's not anything, outside of just driving the story forward. I know critics have compared him to a kind of a watchmaker,
Stephen King had that great quote about he was like a Swiss watchmaker and makes the rest of us look like we make $5 watches.
$5 watches. And because a couple of his ideas, particularly Rosemary's Baby and Stepford Wives, we'll get to, they really intersect with, social consciousness. And I mean, the question of whether the Stepford Wives, like what way of feminism it is, or whether that's worth talking about on its own terms. But we have this idea now, really popularized by a filmmaker like Jordan Peele, who wasn't inventing anything new when he said he called Get Out a social thriller, but he was putting a frame around a tendency I think everybody recognizes. And I think Levin, late 1950s, 60s, 70s, was someone who helped establish the boundaries of that genre. He didn't invent it. He didn't even necessarily but he practiced it,
It kind of, it reminded me of like the Twilight Zone, that sort of almost
Absolutely.
Postmodern,
And I think,
commentary on society, but without trying to like make a point first, which is what I think he did well.
Well, you're so right. I mean, he's like the photo negative of Rod Serling, which is they almost both seem to work backwards from the twist, or with an innate understanding of how to pull the rug out. But yeah, with Rod Serling, it's always to score a point about society. And Levin, in the rare occasions where he was interviewed, he's adamant, I don't have an agenda. I don't
No.
have this. I'm not making any kind of statement, which is a kind of trust the tale rather than the teller thing.
Yes.
Because especially Rosemary's Baby and Stepford Wives were so zeitgeisty that he can deny it all he wants. But we should also say, too, as a writer, he's such a meticulous practitioner. I mean, he wrote a lot of novels and plays and even a children's play that, you know, did not capture the popular imagination but kept him working.
Yeah.
And he also wrote one of the longest running plays in the history of Broadway as a thriller, which is Death Trap,
I love that. Yes.
which did become a movie.
Yeah.
Which is very self-reflexive about what it means to try and be a writer. It's like his version of Misery. You know, you mentioned
Yeah.
King, so Death Trap would be for him what Misery is for King, like a kind of meditation on being a successful writer and how hard it is to keep coming up with ideas.
Yes. Yeah, that is such a brilliant play. I didn't realize he was the one behind that. Just like when I was doing a little bit of reading, I hadn't realized he also wrote No Time for Sergeants, which was also a movie and a fun one, and then Critics' Choice. So I didn't realize he had sort of a background with comedy. Yeah.
No, he and that's just it. He called himself, or he self-described himself, as an entertainer. He always said that that was his goal. He was an educated guy. He was from the Bronx in New York. He won a, I think, a TV writing contest to give him a
Yes.
professional credit, and then, you know, moved forward into this bestseller. He wrote Kiss Before Dying, which he said, you know, really established him with publishers. And then after that, it really was just this idea of churn. You know, he just kept making stuff. And he would sort of say that his interest was driven by research, as opposed to his research being driven by interest. Like he said with Rosemary's Baby, he didn't have any interest in the occult or witchcraft. I think he gave an interview where he's like, well, my family needed to eat. So
Ah, there
he became an authority on mid-60s, you know, witchcraft, which is a very suggestive period.
you
When you
go.
think of it as the period of, you know, the burgeoning cult scene in Los Angeles, the Mansons, the Church
Yeah,
of Satan,
Satanic Panic started.
Panic. But it didn't come from a place inside him that was, you know, he didn't take, he didn't have a masterful personality. There's no cult of personality around him. You know, he wasn't a dark figure. He didn't have a strange life. There weren't weird coincidences. It was always just kind of the work. And as I think talk about today, it really is an interesting case study in film adaptation because, you know, there are these perfect plots that
Yeah.
directors can do all kinds of things with. And if you're talking about a great filmmaker like Polanski, in some ways, Rosemary's Baby works because Polanski sublimated himself to the novel. It's one of the most faithful adaptations you will ever find.
Yes. Yeah, pulled so much dialogue. Yep.
So much dialogue and description. And then some of the other movies that were made of his books, unfortunately, are not made by as distinguished filmmakers, and they kind of are just almost like books on tape, you know?
Yeah.
Although I
Yeah.
think there's interesting things to say about all of them.
I agree with you. I love what you were saying about the research and him going down those rabbit holes and just the family needed to eat. I'm recording this at Poison Pen Bookstore, which is my day job. And last night we had Chuck Wendig here, and he
Oh.
was talking about how he doesn't really like researching, but he's interested in a lot of things. And so he said, you know, like I was reading a lot about apples, like all of a sudden, why are there so many apples? And then, well, I guess I can do something with this. So that way he doesn't purposely go down a rabbit hole for research for a book. It's just stuff he's interested in. And so it's interesting that that's Ira Levin a little bit too. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, he's self-effacing. I mean,
Yeah.
sometimes when not a lot of material on a writer, it's because of some kind of mystery or controversy or some digging that needs to be done. He's not evasive. He's
No.
just quite, again, self-effacing and quiet. It reminds me a little bit of Thomas Harris, who
Yeah.
also is a sort of a, not, he is in no way a disciple of Levin, but another writer whose work lent itself so well to cinema.
Yeah.
But Harris, I think, cultivates mystery around himself a bit. You know, Levin
Yeah,
missed
he
the social
did.
media age. So unless people sought him out for a quote, he kind of seemed to keep to himself.
I love the quote he talked about with his plots, where the thing that interested him most when he was thinking, should I write about it, is would this generate an actual paragraph in the New York Times?
New
Is it
York Times.
that interesting? And if it's not, then why waste somebody's time? And I thought, oh, that's something more writers should maybe think about. Yeah.
Yeah, and speaks to what I would call, and it's not in all the books, but in Rosemary's Baby, there is a kind of diaristic, journalistic aspect to the writing, where
Yeah.
he really kind of wrote it a little bit. You know, he wrote it as a calendar, of 1965, 66, where anytime something happened in the New York Times or in the wider culture, he made a note and he said, well, Rosemary and Guy should see that or hear that or read that. And that's because he really was a realist. You know, among the genre writers, Rosemary's Baby was a bit out of his comfort zone in terms of being supernatural, because Stepford Wives and even Boys from Brazil, which is a good book and a ridiculous movie,
Oh my gosh, yes.
they're science fictional opposed to supernatural or uncanny. That's why Rosemary's Baby mischaracterizes him. People see him as having written one of the great occult pop novels, which it is, I think, the best one as a novel. But that's not his thing. You know, he's not
No.
Stephen King. He's not, you know, God help us, you know, Dean Koontz or
No.
these other mass market guys. Always a realism first writer, you know, where people eat, what they read, fashion, culture. And because he established that stuff so smartly, when the uncanny things start happening around the edges, you're invested in it, you know?
Well, we talked about covering a few of these movies, and we thought it might be a good idea to go chronologically. So, as you mentioned, his first novel he won an Edgar Award for, Kiss Before Dying, became a movie twice. Second one, I remember Razzie attention, we won't get into that. I found it entertaining still, but the first one is a much better film, of course. So, talk to me about A Kiss Before Dying.
Well, Kiss Before Dying was a bidding war, I think, as a novel. You know, Daryl Zanuck bought the rights in the early 50s because he saw that it had commercial potential. The novel is very much in conversation with, let's say, a couple. I thought immediately about actually a couple of female genre writers. It's like Dorothy Hughes in Lonely Place, and certainly the Patricia Highsmith of Ripley, where you are made complicit in the kind of social climbing, ruthless predations of a kind of a very mediocre guy. And it's like in A Lonely Place, in that a lot of his violence comes out of his war service. But he's kind of nameless and faceless in the first part of the book. And you know, the material that everyone knows from it, because it's so striking, is this like really predatory romance where he finds this rich girl and knows he's going to inherit her money, gets her pregnant, realizes that the father is not going to be happy with the child out of wedlock, and that instead of getting rich, he's going to get stuck with this woman and her kid. He stages a suicide while killing her. And it's all so matter of fact.
Oh
And
my
then.
gosh, I know. Like, he even gives her the pills and she doesn't take the pills. Joanne Woodward, it's Robert Wagner, which has its own little meta quality, but yes.
Well, and then in the book, we'll talk about the movie in a sec, but in the book, the narrative reframes around the dead woman's sister. And there is one of my favorite things in any kind of story is when it's not the twist ending, but it's the twist that reframes the narrative while there's still narrative left. I'm a huge fan, not to digress too much, but like one of my favorite studio movies of the last 25, 30 years is this David Tui movie called The Perfect Getaway, which has a
Oh, that's
twist.
such a good one.
Such a good movie. It has a twist 2/3 of the way through that would be a good ending, but then it keeps going. And in A Kiss Before Dying, the twist, which is not a spoiler because it's in the movie and it's in both movie adaptations, is that the dead woman's sister has a boyfriend, and the narrative reveals about 100 pages in that the dead woman's sister's boyfriend is the killer, and that she doesn't know this.
I love the way we find that out. It's just like all of a sudden, there he is.
There he
And
is. You know, she goes, oh, bud, it's you. And you realize from where he has just been in the narrative part, and then part of the narrative from his point of view, because she kind of encounters him after he's done something else. And we realize that the space that they're in and where they are and where they're talking, this has been the guy. William Goldman does the same twist in a different way in Marathon Man about 20 years later, where you find out operative is the main character's brother, and he's treating them like two separate characters, but they're the same. And so then you are reading the book going, oh shit, she's fucked. I mean, she's dating this killer. Now
Absolutely.
in the book, there is a third section where he actually goes through two sisters. He murders two of them, and then
Oh
the
my
third one
God.
catches him. Neither movie goes that far.
Yeah, that would almost be, too much.
It's too
But
much.
Yeah, but I
And so.
do love the way that that just plays out. Like it's a few months later, we're following new character, the aftermath of this horrible crime, and it's just he just walks in. It's also kind of the same decade with Place in the Sun and that,
Absolutely.
American Tragedy adaptation, but this is like the popular culture, the crime, the, as you were saying, the Highsmith version of that, essentially.
Well,
Yeah.
yeah, and like Highsmith, it's got this uncommon. I mean, Levin doesn't strive to make you as complicit in what he's doing, but you're kind of stuck with him in the first part, and then when you realize in the second part, you're stuck with him again, and that now he's in this other woman's life. It's very insidious. It's like perfectly engineered little perspectival shift.
Yeah.
Anticipates how much his novels, I mean, this is a feature of genre writing, but how much it is not about cheating, but about a kind of ethical restriction of point of view, where
Yes. And it alienated critics for that reason, too. Yeah.
it did. He got really kind of like angry reviews, and the movie did too. I mean, the movie is quite tame, even by 50s noir standards, but under the Hays Code, there was some concern about even using the word pregnant.
Pregnant. Yes.
You know? And
Exactly. You know
also,
she is, but they can't say it. Yeah.
yeah, and a couple of reviewers cited a kind of what they saw as an excessive cruelty, even though I don't think the movie is any more misanthropic than, Strangers on a Train from a couple of years ago.
No, or even In a Lonely Place or
Or
some
even
of
In a
these
Lonely
other
Place.
ones. Yeah, absolutely.
But Wagner, and yeah, you're right that there is one of those little bits of casting that in retrospect is just a little
Yes.
shivery.
Like in Cold Blood, or sometimes these things
Yes.
happen. Yes.
Sometimes these things happen, but he really does give
Oh,
pretty
he's a very good bot.
sociopath.
Yes.
Yeah.
Joanne Woodward is great. This was one of her first performances I read, and yeah.
But I mean, you think about the fact that when you have him playing this kind of predatory opportunist, this is around the time that he's dating, still a teenage Elizabeth Taylor. And I don't like to
Yeah.
gossip. I mean,
Oh,
gossip and
no, we're not.
have. No, they have a place interlacing, but let's just say that Wagner
Yeah,
is
Place in
slight.
the Sun, Elizabeth Taylor. Yeah, a
He has a
couple years
slightly
later.
Lees-coded quality in that part,
Yeah.
And the movie's directed by Gerd Oswald, who I think in the American cinema, I don't have it in front of me, but like he certainly didn't rate a whole chapter from Saris. I think he was either under expressive esoterica or subject for further research because he was much more, industrious as a TV director, but he's an interesting filmmaker. He's a German director who came to the US in the 30s, like other German filmmakers you could, or European filmmakers you could point to. And he really churned out a bunch of movies at Monogram Pictures before, moving up to kind of A or high B level films. So I don't know if you've ever seen stuff like Crime of Passion or Brainwashed, but they're all pretty
No.
credible little B movies.
Okay. I know
And
he
I
did a
think
lot of television too,
a lot
like,
of TV.
yeah, Bonanza, Twilight Zone, Perry Mason, yeah.
And just interesting that he got hired for it because it was a valuable property.
Yeah.
And I
Yeah,
think
a
that
bidding war, like you said.
And in the interviews that I read, a couple people who worked on the movie said they felt Oswald was sort of underestimated, or that maybe he was hired because, they felt like he could be controlled. But the movie is very sort of slickly and efficiently made. It is hard, and this comes up in some of the other Levin books. It's hard to translate the interiority and even the use of correspondence in the book to the film.
Okay.
Works, but it's not, to me, it's not as absolutely, compelling as the novel version.
Yeah.
The remake, did you watch it?
Yes, I did, but it's been years since I've seen that one.
Because the remake adds an interesting gimmick whereby both sisters, it still only has the two, but they're both played by Sean Young.
That's right. Yeah.
So it creates a kind of doppelganger twist where
A
not
little bit of a
only,
vertigo thing. Yeah.
yeah, a bit of a vertigo thing, and it casts, and I think he's actually really good in it. It's Matt Dillon
I
who,
think he was great. Well, I'm a big fan of Matt Dillon. I think he's underrated. Yeah.
he's really good, but you can feel in the remake, I think it's James Dearden who directed it. It's such a casualty of a lot of late 80s, early 90s thrillerisms.
Yeah.
It has no stylistic personality of its own. It's made contemporary. It kind of just descends into this faceless, anonymous, hacky violence. You know, it
Yeah.
and the fate of the Matt Dillon character is just ridiculous. They have a kind of Deus Ex Machina versus via train at the end of the movie, which is quite unintentionally funny. I think the remake kind of was nominated for a few Razzies and was just not taken seriously. I know that Dylan got the part over River Phoenix, and Fonda was supposed to play the lead ahead of Sean Young. I mean, Sean Young, an actress, where sort of just chaos and infamy seemed to follow her at a certain point,
Absolutely.
unfortunately. But the movie was not very good.
No. Well, it's interesting you were talking about how Oswald was kind of underrated because I found this great quote from Robert Wagner. Actually, he said, "We rehearsed a lot, but when it was set, it was pretty well set. There was not a lot of improvisation. Gerd was very loyal to the story, but was always looking for ways to make it better. He was a very creative man into texture, backlighting."
Yeah, no, so the idea of Oswald as a kind of anonymous hire, obviously keeps that film well. And yet it's interesting because you do a lot of you have people come on and talk about, noir and crime films a lot, but I don't think you've had Kiss Before Dying before because
No.
it's not considered particularly canonical.
No, not at all.
I think it suffers in a way by comparison to the adaptations that it is narratively similar to. But
Exactly. Like you were bringing up.
we can locate it as where Levin starts becoming, let's say, an in-demand creator of source material for films. Yeah.
And then, of course, the next movie, his most famous, Rosemary's Baby, based on the novel. Like we were saying, Roman Polanski being extremely faithful to the novel. I read something like the first version of the screenplay was 217 pages or something like that. Yeah, this is a film that I had not seen in over 25 years. It was a
Oh,
long
wow.
time ago. So I loved revisiting it because when you watch it, in your late teens, early 20s, it's a totally different thing than in your 40s. Absolutely. It's cool to have watched it back to back with Stepford Wives, which we're also going to discuss because it deals with, paranoia and women's lib and all of those things. But, there's that theory about how every movie, no matter the genre or the plot, is really about filmmaking. And so on some level, watching it this time, it's like, oh, it's a little bit of a cautionary tale about actors. And I made the joke online and immediately Chris Eigman replied and he said, The Exorcist, the other one of the greatest horror movies of all time, is also about an actor, which I thought was funny.
Yeah, they are both about actors, and they kind of are about, I mean, Rosemary's Baby, weirdly, is sort of about stage managing. It's constantly, but I mean, anything that is a conspiracy narrative, you can apply to filmmaking in a negative sense, which is Rosemary is being handled and stage managed and directed and placed in these different, positions, which in terms of Polanski's relationship to actors and actresses, especially in female characters, I mean, with Polanski, this is one of the movies that has survived his reputation, not because the other movies are compromised at all artistically by who he is or what he did, but it's such a pop culture monster that people dress as Rosemary for Halloween or put it in conversation. I feel like even more than Chinatown, in a way, it survives the myth of the dark myth of Polanski, but it's also so generative of those dark myths. Like in Wanted and Desired, the prosecutor talks about going to see a Polanski film festival with Rosemary's Baby in it and seeing like corruption meeting innocence over water in the
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking about Knife on Water and all these things.
where she's raped in her dream on the boat. And I'm like, this prosecutor should be a film critic. I mean, this is a really apt description, but in the movie, and we're talking about Levin more than we are Polanski, but you can, on the one hand, look at the film and see, oh, this is a, subconsciously, you can see all the things that Polanski fetishizes and is capable of. But then you realize is word for word, beat for beat, faithful to the novel, which doesn't mean that Polanski brings nothing of himself to it, but it is a way less, it's kind of an impersonal piece of direction. It's brilliant. It's very much functional. And he treats the book like gospel, you know, like the copy of Time magazine reading Is God Dead, or the weirdness of the Japanese photographer. People go, oh, those are the Polanski touch. And it's like, well, they're not. They're his good sense to keep the book.
Yeah, I read that he was offered this in Downhill Racer, and he read this one overnight immediately and was like, this is the one. But yeah, it is interesting because he does kind of revisit these same things, especially with his female characters. One of the movies he made that I love that never gets talked about enough is Frantic. And so it's interesting if you, like you were saying, a Polanski Film Festival, if you watch all of the female characters, you know, you got Repulsion, all these things that happen, but this is straight from the novel. So that is very interesting. Yeah. And
Yeah, and it's
also you have the meta quality, like we mentioned with Robert Wagner, but here you have Mia Farrow, who was served divorce papers in front of the cast and crew by Frank Sinatra, who didn't want her to work. And I mean, so there was a lot going on with this one.
well, so many, I mean, so many heavy hitters of different kinds on a production that the movie doesn't betray those tensions. It benefits from them. I mean, like John Cassavetes, who hated the way Polanski made movies and didn't like him much either. I mean, score one for John Cassavetes on the ethical scale for not liking Polanski and his ideas about monogamy and relationships,
Oh
but
yeah, that was like a no-go
no go for him.
for him.
But the resentment he had about, I think, having to pay the bills works with Guy, who really doesn't seem to want to act because he's a passionate actor, but he wants success. I mean, that's the Faustian bargain.
Yeah, the fame.
And it's so interesting that this movie has no interest in the Faustian bargain dramatically. Guy is just completely mediocre. That's what ties it to Kiss Before
Just
Dying.
like Bud. Yes.
Just like Bud, he's completely mediocre. He wants something without earning it.
Oh my gosh, just like Stepford Wives, the
And just like
husband.
Stepford
Yes,
Wives,
these men.
which is why, among other people, you know, my mom, who'll end up listening to this podcast, she always thinks she likes
Hello,
11 because
Mrs.
hi, Evelyn.
Newman.
You know, one of the common denominators is that there's a lot of weak men who instrumentalize women to these different fantasies. And Rosemary's Baby, the movie version, one of the best acting moments of Cassavetes' career, and it's colored, I think, not just by the faithfulness to the novel, but by what we would perceive as Polanski's, you know, misogyny and gender politics. But that bit when Guy is talking to her at the party about her friends,
Oh, wow.
like, and she's like, you know, my friends say this, like, well, your friends are a group of not too bright bitches. And it's
Yes, he
from the
goes into the
book,
bitch thing a lot.
bitch thing. And it's so stingingly contemporary. Even for a film in 68, you just sit
Oh
up
my
and,
gosh.
of course.
Yeah, it's like we've all met that guy. We know. Yes.
And Cassavetes, who, you know, sweetheart in real life,
Yes.
he really invests Guy with just, he's so angry and so feeble. And in some ways, I think it's not just that he's manipulating Rosemary, he resents his own lack of agency. You know?
And it is interesting. It would have been hard for him to play, of course, Cassavetes' most famous quote, the only thing that interests him was love, and that's all he wanted to explore. And he's playing this guy who's just controlling and mediocre. Also, the scene that really is chilling when Hutch, their friend, comes over to the apartment, and then he just like comes in. Oh my gosh. And the glove is missing, and you just know something is rotten in Denmark there. But again, just like that narrative twist in Kiss Before Dying, where all of a sudden Bud is revealed, I do like that. We think something's going on. We know it. They make you doubt a little bit, Mia Farrow, but then enough stuff starts to happen that we get as paranoid before they actually show us stuff, which I love.
Well, and it's amazing how Levin talked, because Rosemary's Baby, he ended up having to talk about. He kind of had to. And he said, I mean, the first thing we said already is that he wasn't that interested in witchcraft, but that he was interested in the idea of a kind of nightmarish pregnancy, which is at the very least a received idea for him. You know, he was a father, but, you know, pregnant. But a lot of women who've written about the book, not that has to be female critics saying this, but women who've written about the book, and certainly women I've talked to, my mom, my wife, you know, they think that the way the novel narrates pregnancy is uncanny. It's like as a source of anxiety and of bodily change and vulnerability in and of itself. And that supernatural aspect is allowed to proliferate in there because it's already so surreal to feel that way, that for it to be shadowed a little bit by, you should be shadowed by this kind of dark satanic plot. Like you can see how someone could miss that. And that's a very witty idea.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up because I'm somebody, I have not had a child, but I, of course, friends and family members. So I've talked about it with them too, but I also just saw it on a different level, the gaslighting. I'm someone who's had like a million health issues and chronic issues. And so when I was watching it and how she wasn't able to choose her doctor or she was going and they weren't giving her the best care or they were doubting her or just like, yeah, there's something wrong. Or I thought, wow, that is very, very uncanny too. Like you were saying, the scene with the friends. So this is one of those taps into the zeitgeist. He wrote this. It's a very 60s, a very of its time, the realism. But boy, does this one and also Stepford Wives still play like gangbusters, I think.
Yeah, and they bridge in a way because with Rosemary's Baby, the danger is of something very old being reborn in a sort of new world that has in some ways lost its fear of it. You get the feeling at the end. I mean, the movie play. I mean, one difference is the movie plays the Antichrist's birth and the gathering of the witches. I mean, it's funny in both the book novel and the book, but the movie's really funny. You know,
It's a little over the top. You're like, what?
it's staged in such a not it's not camp, but it's absurd. I love the bit where the knife falls on the floor and then you see Ruth Gordon bend over to clean up the spot, you know, which is just another great Levin detail. But you know, in Rosemary's Baby, this ancient evil, you know, re-manifesting in New York, and then the Stepford Wives is sort of more about using technology to return to a kind of, you know, post-war past. But we should say in between, because you know, if we're going to leave Rosemary's Baby, the sequel novel to Rosemary's Baby is one of the worst books I've ever read in my life.
I don't know that story or the.
It's called Son of Rosemary, and it got a lot of attention when it came out because, as I recall, it's the very late 90s, and it's almost like one of those. Everyone has examples of this by an artist who they like, or people going back to their own intellectual property. It's almost like it's written on a dare to ruin everybody's memories of it. And
Like
there's a.
that moment in The Player with the Graduate sequel that's kind of played for a joke in the
Sure, The
beginning.
Graduate Part Two, yeah. So Son of Rosemary not only does the thing that the original novel would never dream of doing, which is like, what would the Antichrist be like when it has him as a person? But it also goes back and kind of like invalidates and erases the narrative of the original. It does this ridiculous, you know, was it all a dream?
Oh,
It's
no.
like it's informed by him having to live down Rosemary's Baby. And
He did kind of get apologetic about it because he called himself a Jewish atheist and said he wasn't interested in Satanism and he regretted the amount of movies that came after The Omen and The Exorcist and how people were actually believing in that.
Well, and when they did the Rosemary's Baby miniseries
Oh,
in
yeah.
2014, which I watched with great interest because my old high school classmate, Patrick Adams of Suits fame, played the Guy Woodhouse role, they integrate aspects of Son of Rosemary into that miniseries. Like it's like a co-adaptation of Rosemary's Baby and Son of Rosemary.
Interesting. I didn't watch it.
But the novel was just so badly reviewed. And I think it's one of the last things he wrote, and it's sort of sad thing. It's his last novel, and you know, really sort of like it doesn't destroy the legacy, but it undermines it because it's not like someone else pounced on the material like they did with kind of Pale Retread. Like he wrote it himself, and it's very weak.
Yeah, that's too bad. When I was looking at his career, around the time he wrote Son of Rosemary, a Sliver came out. I had no idea that he had anything to do with Sliver. So
Sliver.
that was fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, Sliver being a kind of early 90s sleaze
Yeah.
classic.
Yeah. I want to read the book because, Corinna Longworth has talked about it so much, and also the ending of Sliver being different because the ending bothered me in the movie. And once I heard that, I was like, oh, wow. So yeah, I do want to read it for fun.
Yeah, and a movie that, slots in so nicely with, Disclosure and these
Yep.
kind of like early 90s, not just sleaze, but like tech sleaze.
Yes.
But the novel, which I think was written, when was the novel written? The novel was written earlier. It was, oh, no, it was all, still
Oh,
1991.
okay.
So yeah, he's interested in contemporary, interested in contemporary surveillance, which again shows, as you say, that interest in, would the New York Times write a feature on this, and how can I turn that into a
Yeah.
piece of genre fiction?
Yeah. So, Rosemary's Baby, do you have any more you want to add to that before we move on to Stepford?
No, because I think that a lot of what's great about the movie is kind of self-evident. I think that what isn't what people, and I also don't think this is like unknown about it, but it's, if anyone's listening to this and they choose either to read the book because they like the movie, or watch the movie because they like the book, the ratio of images and ideas is like virtually one to one. And I think that Polanski's camera obviously lets him carve out some space for the kind of filmmaker he is, the voyeurism of the camera, the peering around corners, the sort of
Yes, I
the way that.
love the peering around and also the blocking where people are. Yeah, it's great.
But it's a great example of something that completely serves material. Whereas there's other writers whose, when their books get turned in to movies, they almost become like armatures or clothes hangers for directors to kind of do all kinds of tricks and turn all kinds of pirouettes and, leaven the other movies. I think we're going to now start experiencing a sharp downturn in their quality, though I'm curious to know what you think of the film version of Stepford Wives. But Rosemary's Baby succeeds not because Polanski talked down to the novel or treated it like trash or tried to depart from it. I think maybe in the last moment before Roman Polanski became capital letters Roman Polanski, this movie made him that kind of celebrity. And informed the infamy of his wife's murder because of the satanic.
Oh, I know.
This is kind of the last time I think that Polanski could have made a movie for a lot of reasons where he was not a giant flashing sign over the movie.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking.
And it's interesting too, one thing we didn't note, but I love the connection that the movie has all these heavy hitters. Robert Evans was running Paramount, and we have all these stars, but the rights were bought by, William Castle, who's a schlockmeister. And I love the idea.
Yes, and he knew he couldn't direct it. And he
And
just said, yeah, he's like, I'll produce.
Knew he couldn't direct it. There are rumors it was offered to Hitchcock, which
Yeah,
honestly,
Truffaut said that.
might have been too on the nose. But, suffice it to say, great, great movie. And I would guarantee, I would not guarantee, I would assume probably the one that your listenership of all the movies we're talking about, I would be shocked if people haven't seen it.
Yeah, when I was watching it this time, another film, I think because of the paranoia and also, like you were saying, the peering around corners and the blocking, like the phone booth scene, brought up in my mind, Fincher's The Game, which is one of my favorite movies he made. Just as it
Sure.
gets more and more paranoid, I love that.
Yeah, and I mean, no, that it's a, great comparison. And I think that in the last couple of years, we've seen some movies play very smartly with Rosemary's Baby, even in the first Omen, which is more immediately a Omen prequel. I mean, it's at least universe, it pays a certain debt stylistically to Rosemary's Baby. Immaculate, which came out last year with Sydney Sweeney, does so. The shadow that that movie casts, because of the way it aligns you with this character's point of view, and you're limited and trapped, which again is Levin's thing. I mean, in the novel, he never pulls back. You never get a scene with Minnie and Roman in their apartment, or you never see where Guy goes. You're with Rosemary the entire time. And so vulnerability is your vulnerability, her suspicions are your suspicions. Really fine piece of writing.
Yes. Well, I've seen both versions of Stepford Wives. I don't really remember the Frank Oz one very much. I think I thought it was okay. I really liked the cast a lot, the costuming. But I actually do, it's not Rosemary's Baby by any means, but I like the 1975 Stepford Wives. I think Katherine Ross is very good. It's eerie. It's kind of, you can see somebody like Mark Cherry watching that and thinking, I'm going to make Desperate Housewives and some of the things that came later. It does tip its hand maybe earlier than the way that I liked in some of the previous films. I'm not sure how loyal it is because I haven't read the book. But yeah, what did you think?
Well, I just, you always play the sliding doors game with who could have made something, and sometimes it's
Yeah.
pointless, but the rumor, because there's a really interesting marriage of writers here before we talk about the director, because William Goldman did the script, and
Yes.
Goldman is not just, I mean, he's a peer of Levin's. He's
Yeah.
much more famous because he liked talking about himself so much. I mean, he
Oh my
wrote
gosh, I know. And you have to take some of those stories with a grain of salt. Yes.
salt. But I mean, around the time that Goldman was adapting Stepford Wives, this would have been, him writing a novel like Marathon Man or a
Yeah.
screenplay like All the President's Men. So he's a contemporary of Levin's. I think he was more successful in Hollywood first. I mean, he'd have already done stuff like Butch Cassidy. I don't necessarily think that he's a better writer, but we don't really know because his script got rewritten by this director, Brian Forbes.
Yes. Yeah.
And
And he
so
talked
Gold.
about how much he hated that ending.
He
Yep.
said he hated the ending, but there's also a version, and this is also Goldman putting himself in the center of this kind of contentiously. This movie was offered to Brian De Palma.
I was going to say he would have, oh, I would love to have seen the Brian De Palma version, especially coming at around the time of like Sisters and these sort of things. Oh my gosh, would have been great.
Because Sisters, which is an original script, is Sisters an original script by De Palma? I forget if
I
Sisters.
believe it is. Yeah.
I think it's an original script. I mean, it certainly has his preoccupations in
Yes.
it, but I mean, De Palma is a great filmmaker of conspiracy and a
Yeah.
filmmaker of limited perspective. And Brian Forbes is a much more of a sort of a journeyman filmmaker. He'd made a good genre film. I don't know if you're a fan of it, called Seance on a Wet Afternoon with
Yeah,
Dick
I
Powell.
haven't seen that since college, but yeah.
But so he had kind of horror chops or genre chops, but I find the way he made the film, and maybe it's in line with his rewriting the script, it's very workmanlike and it lacks the sort of playful creepiness you get with a Polanski. It's a
Yeah.
very literal treatment, which maybe works for a story that's about things that are mechanical, but
Yes, it's too
it doesn't
straightforward.
have it's very straightforward, but it's not bad.
No, it's entertaining for sure. But yes, you wish it had more of the mystery and more of, like you said, the playfulness. And also, like some of the things that happen, especially in Sisters, now that I'm thinking, the ending with the phone and the like, as stakes increase and Katherine Ross gets more and more scared that she's going to be changed by the men of this community into like this perfect sex object, subservient woman. Like you can imagine what somebody like De Palma could have done with those scenes. Yeah.
Well, we should note, or I think it's, I don't know what you think of this. I haven't read this connection, or I'm sure I've read it, but it seems very intuitive that whether it was an influence on Levin or not, the movie that Stepford Wives draws on in some ways is Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's just that
I
it does.
love that movie, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not an alien threat, but it's that idea that the danger, the fear is of conformity.
Yep.
And I think the question with Katherine Ross is she expressive or empathetic or weird enough to feel like a non-Stepford wife in the first place. And I think
Yeah. I think she needed to be almost like the friend was a little bit bolder and
well,
yeah, Bobby,
Paula
Paul
Prentice. Yeah,
Apprentice.
well, she's such a life force that when she
Yeah.
leaves,
The contrast, yes.
you're very upset. But this is also contemporaneous with something like Westworld, so it speaks to this. The consumerization of technology, the advancement of robotics, and the idea here for sure of women being, again, instrumentalized for male pleasure. I mean, that's the
Yeah.
conspiracy, is that the husbands, it's like a whole bunch of guy Woodhouses.
Yes, yeah, it's like AI before AI or sex dolls. It was weird watching this in Trump's America,
Right.
essentially, and this idea of the trad wife and all of that. But yeah, I think it plays well still. Again, just like Rosemary's Baby, certain aspects and certain scenes are still going to hit, but it isn't that movie, no.
No, and you can see, again, taken from the novel, it tries to broaden that social perspective by integrating the aspect, you know, the relation, the adventures or the experiences of an African American family,
Yes.
the idea that, you know, the unspoken common denominator, even across racial boundaries, is this desire for a kind of, you know, submissive wife. But it
Yeah.
also ties that idea, which is a very 50s sci-fi idea modernized, where it's like, yeah, trad wife and kind of domestic bliss, but tied to this idea of gadgetry, right?
Yep.
Like, it's not just that a woman's place is in the kitchen, but she's basically like an oven, you
Yes.
know, or she's
Yes.
like a refrigerator. And that's something that is harder, I think, to put on screen than the occult, because in Rosemary's Baby, the less you see, the scarier it is. In Stepford Wives, it does kind of have to show you robotics a little bit. And suffice it to say, it's not brilliantly done.
No,
You
but at
know?
least it's better than The Boys from Brazil, which, like, gun to my head, I don't know if I could explain some of the things that happened in that movie.
Right.
It's bananas, but I had never seen it before. So I'm glad I can now say, yes, I have seen that. Yes.
Well, Pauline Kael wrote that in The Boys from Brazil, it's like the actors are all wearing price tags.
Yeah, Olivier needed the money. Peck wanted to work with Olivier. I love how so many of them just like that still happens. Like they want the experience, they want the hang, they want to work with each other. Oh, my friend's in that. But everyone wanted to work with Olivier, and that poor bastard just needed the money. Yes.
Needed the money. And at that point, Ira Levin was like money in the bank as an adaptation, because it's
Yeah.
after Rosemary's Baby and after Stepford Wives. Now, I confess that that's the novel, not confess, I say happily, that's the novel I read the most when I was 10 or 11. My mom had a copy of it, and I loved reading it because, on paper, I have to say, it's a wonderfully preposterous plot. For anyone who doesn't know the plot, it takes a little more explaining than Stepford Wives. I mean, Stepford Wives is simple, you know.
Yes.
And woman moves into this community, realizes all the other women are like vaguely robotic, and surprise, they are.
Yes.
But Boys from Brazil begins with this like Nazi confab in deepest South America, where
With, yes,
Joseph
Gutenberg in
Mengele
the
is alive.
movie, which I love.
Okay, you didn't bring me, but like Joseph Mengele is alive and well, and he's like, listen, everybody, all of our Nazi resources have to go into killing a bunch of old men over the next few years in every country in the world. And his subordinates, these various concentration camp guards, like, we should say this is all in the worst taste, and it's in
Oh,
such
yes.
bad taste.
Yeah.
But they're all like, why are we killing these guys? And that's the mystery that the protagonist, played by in the film by Laurence Olivier, who's based on Simon Wiesenthal. He's not really Simon Wiesenthal. He's
No.
you know, a composite figure, this Nazi hunter. He is trying to figure out these murders. They're not heads of state. They're not even
No.
deities. And ultimately, you know, it's because they are all, drum roll, you know, fathers of adopted, genetically engineered Hitler clones. So
Yes.
the novel becomes this meditation on nature and nurture, which is to bring Hitler back, you can't just clone him and give him to a bunch of families. You have to recreate the circumstances of his childhood.
Yeah.
So pulpy and wonderful. But in the
It's just
movie,
insane. Yeah.
it's insane. It's all very overproduced by Franklin Schaffner, and you just sit around watching old men get killed in very non-photogenic ways. And it's so like calcified and slow and creaky. Like, the whole movie feels so tired.
I can confess, I started it like after I got home from work, and I got like 35 to 40 minutes in, and it kind of like was wallpaper, like I glazed. I had to start the damn thing. I'm like, did I
Over again.
miss something like that's explaining this? Not really. No.
And you have this pattern where you cut from Olivier going to all these different countries where he goes to the house and there's this like young, pretty mother and this kind of like Hitler clone, and he's like, that's weird, these kids look the same. And then cutting to South America, where James Mason, who is so bad, is doing a German accent while wearing, sporty lake gear, talking to Gregory Peck, who's also terrible.
Yeah, it's like Calvin Klein, but
Calvin
not.
Klein, but not, and they're like, is the plan working? This plan's crazy. And, when you get to the revelation 2/3 of the way through, where he meets this scientist who explains cloning, and he figures out that it's Hitler. It's not a revelation. It's kind of, you're just like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And Cale also was very sad. She's like, we never get the vision we want of all the 93 cloned Hitlers. I mean,
No.
you get is you get one kid while two old guys fight on the floor for a gun at the end.
I
It's such a
know. Yeah.
deflating thing.
Yeah. You have Peck and Olivier who are like fighting on the ground essentially at that stage in their career, and you just kind of feel bad. Yeah.
Yeah, you feel bad for them, and the movie kind of isn't just content to be pulp. It wants to every so often talk about, the horrors of Nazism and the Holocaust, genocide. Like, it doesn't have the perfect relationship of, let's say, tone that you have in Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, the
It's about the
all over
Antichrist.
the place. Yep.
This one's all over the place. It can't really, move from left to right. Interestingly, Laurence Olivier didn't just he won a Golden Globe for this film.
Oh, wow.
And he was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actor. He was the favorite. When John Voight won for Coming Home, it was considered a bit of an upset
Oh, wow.
because Olivier's performance is so theatrical. He's got the accent, he's limping,
Yes.
he's
He's acting
overly
with a
lit.
capital A. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, he's very charming, but casting Gregory Peck, casting Atticus Finch as a Nazi scientist is sort of one of the nadirs of casting. I mean, he's just so bad.
Yeah. It's horrible. Yeah, this is not a good one, but it's from that era, like you were saying, Westworld, Rollerball, Marathon Man, just all of these, all of,
Well, Marathon Man is the one it pairs with in that it's kind of Nazi themed, Nazi
yeah, but that's the
space,
right way to go. Yeah.
right way to go. And also the participation in both of Laurence Olivier. The
Yeah.
film is like very long and heavy and overproduced and bloated and lots of location shoots. When I watched it recently, I'd actually watched it before we proposed the pod. I was struck by how what it seemed to represent,
Yeah.
quite apart from Ira Levin or anything that it's trying to do, it feels like the end of one kind of overproduced 70s blockbuster because there's no special effects in it. And you can sort of see that by 1978, this kind of movie, like a Day of the Jackal type movie, is not going to
Yeah.
work for a mass audience. You're going to need something sleeker, more streamlined, more
Yeah.
science fiction,
Exactly.
Because in the
Yeah.
80s, there's no real equivalent to something like Boys from Brazil. It's like a last gasp of the high gloss A-list 60s, 70s studio thriller.
Yeah, kind of like Hello, Dolly the decade before with that. Yeah,
Dramatical.
for that genre. Yes. Well, then after this, of course, Death Trap, which we didn't watch ahead of time to prepare, but I love Death Trap. Are there any other Ira Levin movies, thoughts?
No, because it was a, I mean, that's one of the other reasons that he's interesting is as a novelist, the quality control filter was pretty tight, and they
Yeah.
made movies out of pretty much all of them, but there weren't too many to do, right?
Yeah.
Boys from Brazil is written in 76. There's a long break before he does Sliver. I think that in the 80s, he probably was just, getting those Death Trap residuals because it's one of the longest
Yeah.
running plays of all time. I think it's in the top 10 for the longest running
Can't
shows on Broadway.
recommend it enough if people haven't seen the movie either. Yeah.
Yeah. And as I said off the top, the only thing I'll say about Death Trap, we won't go into it because we didn't choose to talk about the movie, but
Yeah.
insofar as it is about a popular writer struggling with his popularity and a lack of inspiration, it might be the closest Levin ever came to doing something personal,
Yes,
where
I
instead
agree
of
with you.
devils or witches or Nazis, it's quite internal. But the movie version is so well cast. It's one of the I mean, it's a great Christopher Reeve performance, but Kane is terrific.
Yeah, the two of them together, amazing. Yes.
Yeah. So, and again, he in his late years, he didn't produce very much. Son of Rosemary was the last thing, that he wrote. So again, we're not talking about a big public life, but I think it's a pretty fascinating legacy. And
Yeah.
almost every movie, the five or six that were made from his novels, has something sort of juicy to chew on and recommend it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Are there any other books that he wrote that didn't become movies or any favorites?
Well, there's This Perfect Day,
Okay.
which is his dystopian, futuristic novel, never made into a movie. It's set in a kind of Brave New World, and it's post Brave New World. I think one reason that it's not considered all that great is it's seen as somewhat derivative,
Oh.
But it's set in one of these worlds where everyone is kept in check. They're, kept quiet with drugs. They're told how to marry and who they're supposed to reproduce, and then they're humanely euthanized. Like, you can feel this whole, Soylent Green or Brave New World or Logan's Run. It's kind of in that tradition.
Sure.
And as I recall, it has these kind of interesting, I mean, interesting, they're very broad, but this kind of political subtext where the future is made equally in the image, at least in the minds of the people, Jesus Christ and Karl Marx, and it's
Yeah.
about obviously pushing back against this dystopia and sort of trying to be a nonconformist. So in that sense, it does line up with the Stepford Wives.
Yeah, these Swiss
But
watch plots. Yeah.
Swiss Watch Plus, but if you compare it to contemporaneous books and movies, it is not on the order of even something like THX-1138 or Logan.
Yeah.
But it's strange, given how much of a money machine he was, that they never made a movie version. I don't know enough about why they didn't.
I was going to say, I bet somebody was thinking about it from that at some point. Yeah.
Yeah, especially because, it came out in the mid-70s, so it would have been ripe for adaptation, but no,
Yeah.
did not transpire.
Yes. Well, I'm glad we got to explore these. And I
Absolutely.
want to thank you so much, Adam, for doing this. You always come up with the best ideas. So you're welcome back anytime.
Oh, I always have a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as a dollar per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.